Sometimes our futures turn in an instant. Someone we meet, a phone call, a flyer on a notice board.
It's like the butterfly effect.
And it's not until later that we see the signs.
We're all vulnerable.
When four people vanish from an isolated WA town in 2007, everyone's left wondering what they missed and what they could have done differently. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, the NanUp 4. Binge all episodes now. Search Expanse on ABC Listen and iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One woman died a brutal death. Two men were charged with her murder. A jury convicted them of manslaughter. Now we can tell you what we really think. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to episode 14 of The Case of the Two Intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
During the trial, we can only tell you what the jury hears. But now the verdict is in, we've got much more freedom. And we're going to break down the trial that found out who killed Irma. To do this, we're joined by ABC court reporter Elizabeth Byrne. Liz, I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts on this trial. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Stocky.
And as well as Elizabeth, we're joined by ABC investigative reporter James Viver. James, good to have you here as well.
Hi, Stocky.
First question, when we get into these episodes, is were you surprised by the verdict? Liz?
No, not at all. The evidence against them was quite strong. It was a circumstantial case, and of course, circumstantial cases are made up of strands. They're described as strands of a rope, and in this particular case, the strands all came together, and the strongest bit of it was the DNA evidence. So it was very hard to get past that.
James, how about yourself? Were you surprised by the verdict that the jury reached?
Honestly, it's hard to say because I've not done a murder trial before, so I kind of had nothing to base it on. A lot of the evidence felt, you know, pretty strong, just from a news sense, you know, comparing it to, I suppose, a news sense and a common sense. And a lot of the arguments, which I know we'll get into from the defence side, felt a bit far-fetched, to be honest. And so, you know, that they convicted them, I suppose, I wasn't surprised, but I would qualify that as it's a relatively inexperienced opinion.
Yeah, James, I was a bit like you. I have this real recency bias when I'm listening to arguments. So I'll hear the prosecution opening and I'll be like, oh, well, look, this seems pretty open and shut, doesn't it? And then I hear the defence and go, oh, actually, well, you know, there's some good points there. The thing that sort of surprised me a little bit was that manslaughter was an option. You know, I wasn't expecting the jury to be kind of given that option, you know, given, you know, what we talked about with the family, the history of this case. I thought that maybe the prosecutors wouldn't allow the jury to kind of make that selection. But Liz, as you've explained, it's sort of the next step down, basically, from murder. And so that option was given to the jury. And, you know, I think the thing I was wondering was whether or not the jury would have, you know, reached murder if manslaughter wasn't on the table. I mean, Liz, do you think they would have?
It's possible. The final question the jury asked was they wanted some clarification of the elements of the charges, particularly manslaughter and murder, in circumstances where it's unclear who attacked Irma. So this goes back to the Joint Commission charge. But that question said to me that that's what they're struggling with. Is it murder or is it manslaughter? I may be completely wrong because the jury can't tell us, but that's what it suggested to me. And I've seen this a few times. They may not have gotten to murder because it was unclear who attacked Irma. And quite often with juries who are faced with a circumstance like this and it's drummed into them, you have to find it beyond a reasonable doubt that they end up saying we can't reach a verdict on that particular question. I think, though, all the other charges about the burglary and the assaults, that all stood up, and I think they had already made up their mind on those charges before they got to this final bit.
Yeah, I found myself wondering, you know, when I heard initially that it was, you know, guilty of manslaughter, kind of what the family would think of that. I personally thought, well, look, this was a murder trial. I think that was obviously what the prosecutors were pushing for. And my initial reaction was, you know, how does the family feel about that? But, you know, hearing from John Makita, Irma's grandson, and also Elizabeth, Irma's daughter, outside of court, that they were kind of, you know, just happy that this is over and they were satisfied with the manslaughter charge. For me, I guess kind of gave me some peace that, you know, there was still the closure for the family and this is what this was really all about.
What I would say about that is, you know, on reflection, I wonder, you know, how satisfactory that may have been if they had managed to solve it the first time around, or, you know, when they had another go sort of a decade or so later. You know, the passage of time in a sort of twisted piece of irony, perhaps given now the age of Fekoni and Fabrizi and the sort of the scenario of life that everybody is in, I wonder if just, you know, manslaughter does whatever murder would have done, the practical effect is the same. And like you say, justice has been served and there is that resolution. So, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
Well, the thing that Irma's grandson, John Makita, said outside the court was, someone's been held to account after all these years. And the family was very relieved about that.
Yeah. And I think the, you know, it answers the question, who killed Irma? You know, that was the question that was being asked on those billboards for so many years. And, you know, manslaughter is still a method of killing someone. And so that is the verdict that was handed down in relation to Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Fekoni. James, talking about the kind of the length of time of this investigation, something I found myself coming back to a little bit is just the way, you know, the evidence was collected and presented at the time. You know, we're looking back, you know, 1999 is when this robbery occurred, when Irma was killed. And just the foresight of investigators to collect the evidence that was, you know, most likely kind of crucial in delivering this verdict, the DNA evidence from the fridge. I mean, Liz, it's sort of incredible that, you know, they were able to do that and then get this verdict all those decades later.
Well, probably unlike you, I remember 1999 and I had already been covering courts for quite a while at that time, and we thought DNA evidence was, you know, quite advanced. But what the scientists knew was that they techniques were advancing all the time. It was getting better and better. I have seen a few trials collapse on the basis of DNA evidence that didn't stand up. But as time went on, sort of rates of how you could tell if it was one person against another really improved. The techniques for even uncovering that there was DNA there improved. And they would have known that that was the trajectory of this science. And so the foresight was, you know, probably quite a reasonable thing to expect of them. But, you know, it is pretty incredible that they did go exactly to the right place. And that's because Gregor had remembered seeing somebody take a swig out of something from the fridge, and they knew to test anything you could drink from.
Yeah, there's sort of a humility to it, isn't there, with those scientists in that moment, knowing that just because they are working at the sort of ragged edge of their science today, in a year, 5 years, 10 years, they know it will be better because it wasn't as good before them, if you see what I mean. So it's kind of built into that science that, you know, we will improve, it will improve, the science will improve. And so it's sort of, you know, hopeful for the future. Then they'll keep those samples, those epitubes at minus 80, just on the off chance that it can solve, a murder, manslaughter in a decade's time, 2 decades' time. And so it proved to be.
Yeah, it makes me wonder how much stuff they've got in a freezer at the moment that we'll be talking about in 10, 15, 20 years, yeah, maybe. Who knows? Something I noticed throughout, not just this part, but also kind of the whole defense of Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Fekoni, was really Sky Jerome, you know, Steve Fabrizi's barrister. We spent a lot more time talking about her work than we did Joseph Fekoni's barrister, Travis Jackson. Liz, did Sky Jerome kind of lead the defense for both of these men in a way?
Well, yes, she did. This isn't unusual. It often happens in cases where there's an overlap in what the defence will be. Now, in this particular case, it was poking holes in the forensic evidence that was sort of the best part of their best chance to get their clients off and to introduce, doubt about things that the police had put forward and the prosecutors had put forward. So Skye Jerome did take the lead. She covered all the common ground and then covered some extra ground for her own client, which was, that he had admitted being there, even though he says he was only the lookout. So Travis Jackson was left with the job of pointing out that the only evidence against his client was the DNA evidence. And that was what he focused on mostly as well. But they tried not to cross the, traverse the same grounds, because then you could run the risk of driving the jury and everyone else mad.
Yeah, absolutely. I was kind of surprised to see how much work Skye Jerome was doing over Travis Jackson. And it really did feel like she kind of, was taking the lead and making sure that, the right things were getting into the jury's mind. And, my thinking was throughout the trial was if, either of these men are found not guilty, I would probably imagine that it was more of Skye Jerome's work than Travis Jackson's. James, what were your thoughts? First trial, seeing the way these two barristers worked.
Yeah, it definitely stood out, in the pie chart of the heat map of who had more, game time. Skye Jerome definitely was in the lead there. I don't know, Liz, and you'd be able to tell me this, but there was certainly, I think, performative whispers to solicitors instructing sitting behind the bar table and, performative head shakes and, laughs and all of this from the defence barristers. It felt performative. There may not have been, of course, but it just came at particular moments that felt as though they were. Nevertheless, when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, I just don't think the points, whatever the communication style, what I think or what I don't think, ultimately there's a conviction, but seemed to me that whether it was the way that they were delivered or simply the substance of them, ultimately it's really hard to argue against, 60 quintillion or whatever the number was, to stand there a few minutes later and say, yes, but you can't say it's a match, because that's just the science. That's just the semantics of the science. Mm. Like it is a match. There's only 8 or 9 billion people on the planet. How could it be? If it's in the quintillions, how could it not be a match? It's just so, to sort of stand there and say that, just in the real world, no, you just wouldn't. That just doesn't fly. Mm. And things like, could the dogs have moved the DNA around? And just things which, when we're talking about reasonable doubt, clearly that was unreasonable doubt.
Yeah, the DNA is such, I guess, in hindsight, compelling evidence, placing them in the house. And yeah, the numbers around that are just gigantic, right? So yeah, very hard to argue against. Big task for any defence barrister to come up against. I think one of the other things I found really interesting was the stories that kind of get told in a defence. There's these alternative ideas and explanations for how this may have happened. And one of the ones that was presented by the defence was the idea that there were other people involved, this idea of a third intruder or maybe another, kind of group of people somewhere that was presented. Obviously not something that the jury has bought because of the verdict that they have returned, finding Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ficcone guilty of manslaughter. Liz, why do you think that theory from the defence didn't stick? Where did it fall over?
Well, I think it had too many grey areas. That theory sort of was to serve the purposes of their client, to put someone else in the house. Now, who that was, they didn't really say. They had suggested there'd been a group of people, a group of other people, but there was no sign, no DNA sign or fingerprints or anything of any of those people in the house. They'd all been investigated, in fact, by police early on and rejected. And then as Craig Marriott, the detective who investigated this, said in the court, when it was suggested to him he should have investigated this further, he said that neither Mr. Facconi or Mr. Fabrizi had said anything about this third person. So it kind of, it was there to provide a seed of doubt for the jury, but it had too many grey areas, and I think they just didn't buy it as an even a remote possibility.
Yeah, and the thing that struck me about that is we find out about Facconi in the first instance when Fabrizi is talking to UCO Danny, you know, the syndicate crime boss. So if we take Fabrizi's explanation in that scenario that he was the lookout and that he didn't go in and he didn't know anything about this, why not put another person in the house? What if that if there was a third person, why not talk about there being two people in the house and they must have done it? That gives you more plausible deniability or explainability in that UCO Danny crime syndicate boss scenario. So why not use it if you're trying to explain your way out of something? Mm. And that to me felt like a big hole in that theory too.
Yeah, the undercover recording with Steve Fabrizi and UCO Danny, the Mr. Big operation basically at Crown Casino, I found what we learned from that and then what we hear from Joseph Facconi really surprising. You have, you know, Steve Fabrizi, what it seems like, very reluctantly revealing details about this. Oh yeah, I've never been to Canberra. Oh no, I was there. I was at the house, but I didn't go inside. Slowly kind of revealing more and more about it. And it's like, oh, who were you there with? Oh, some guy, Jovec. He sort of paints this picture. He doesn't know this person. And then you have this interview with Joseph Facconi where they're like, oh, you know, do you know Steve Fabrizi? And he's like, yeah, absolutely, I know Steve Fabrizi. You know, we grew up in Hungary together. We traveled Europe. We met up in Australia. And, you know, in his police interview, he just seemed, this is Joseph Facconi, he just seemed so kind of comfortable and confident. He was very happy to share his kind of life story and talk about, you know, his movement, his family, all of these different things, and just didn't give much away once he got to whether or not he'd ever been to Canberra or his involvement in the robbery in 1999. I mean, Liz, were you kind of surprised in the styles or I guess the confidence of these men when they were dealing with police?
Well, I was. Fabrizi was interesting because he was so remorseful and he kept apologising and looked very defeated because, of course, by then he would have realised he'd been duped by an undercover police officer. Facconi, on the other hand, seemed very relaxed by comparison. And he also, it was like he had his answers ready when they said about the balaclava. He said, oh, well, he might have stolen that from me when I was welding his truck. And then he said, he's got a habit of taking something. That's the kind of person he is. And then he was asked about why Fabrizi might have dobbed him in. And he said, oh, well, he might be jealous of me because I've got a family. Like the animosity Facconi felt towards Fabrizi was, you know, quite different, quite stark. The other thing that jumps out at me is that Facconi would have known they were coming for him because his friend who also knew Fabrizi, had sent him a clip of the news showing the arrest of Fabrizi weeks before Facconi himself was arrested. So he knew they were coming eventually. Yet he sat there. He wasn't like a man who'd been surprised with a charge of murder. He was quite relaxed. And I thought that was an interesting way. I think he thought he could deal with it, dispense with it. But of course, the DNA trapped him.
Yeah, it was fascinating to see just how, yeah, I mean, confident he was in that position. And yeah, just how happy he was to tell his story, yeah, compared to Steve Fabrizi, who just seemed kind of shocked.
The thing that they both have in common, and that is really chilling, particularly for Facconi, you know, they sat there in that room and that, as we now know, they've been convicted. They knew what happened, you know, and certainly we know because of the conviction now that Facconi was a man who sat there in that room knowing, albeit 25 years ago, that he had punched a 70-year-old woman in the face, 70-odd years old. You know, that's chilling. And whatever about who did what and who struck what blow on whom in the house that night, a combination of the two men made that thing happen, and they both knew that. And particularly Vicconi sat there and said he didn't know anything about it when actually he did. You know, this is a violent, brutal, savage attack. You know, they hit her hard enough that her false teeth flew out onto the floor, and, let alone that she, of course, she died of her injuries. And so, you know, whilst we go through the sort of ins and outs of the trial, that is the thing that I am still left with is those two men knew what happened and to a greater or lesser extent showed remorse or didn't, and made admissions or didn't, but still they knew what happened and they still tried to get away with it to a greater or lesser degree.
Liz, what do you think of that kind of assault, the senselessness of it all? Is it something you've come back to much throughout this?
I think it's been the biggest thread through this whole thing. I found it quite shocking, the degree of violence against Irma. And as the autopsy report suggested, it was serious interpersonal violence. There were a lot of injuries on Irma's body. The man who ran the forensic team that examined the house, Clifton Frost, also described some of the injuries to Irma. Now, I see this in, you know, other cases where the victim has survived. It's shocking. I think the terror is the thing that gets to you, the terror she must have felt while that was happening. And it was a significantly more violent attack because of, they can tell from the injuries all over her body, than Gregor appears to have suffered, although he also suffered from quite a few injuries. So I think that, you know, that kind of attack on a woman who was only 73, just it's really quite a terrible thing to contemplate.
You've sat through so many trials, Liz. I mean, does the violence in this one land differently because of the age of the people and the situation they were in that night?
A little bit. But this sort of terrible violence is terrible violence, and I'm pretty sure most victims of something like this would feel the same level of terror. But I suppose from almost from a moral perspective, the idea that older people being subjected to something like this is just really terrible.
Yeah, the thing I find myself kind of thinking about is, you know, my grandparents in a situation like this and how I would feel in, you know, if that was happening to them. And I think probably a lot of people who've been listening to this podcast have thought about that in the sense of their own families, their parents, their grandparents, you know, imagining what would happen if they were in that situation and how they would react and feel about it. James, can you put any reason to the violence of the attack that night?
And again, that's the thing I keep coming back to. No, I can't. That's the thing I keep coming back to is, you know, you're not going in to rob crime bosses or bikies or someone who poses a great threat in this scenario. You're going in to a couple of retirees, you know, winding down for the night watching telly, as Liz said. That I can't see how the risk in the minds of these two men equates to the violence that they meted out. It just seems so unnecessary. Like, if you're going to rob them, tie them up and gag them, you know, not fine, but okay, do that. But why you have to beat them so savagely, that's the bit I don't know, and we will never know, of course. You know, to threaten them to tell them where the money is or whatever it may be, it just doesn't stack up on a human level in so many ways. But that particular point, I suppose, it's just the senselessness of it, really. And you know, it was exactly that, the terror, as Elizabeth Makita said outside court, that is Irma's daughter. Even now, that's what she cannot get out of her head. The thing that stays with her is the fear and the terror and the pain her mother must have been in her final moments. That's the thing that she's lived with for 25 years, and she said, well, you know, we'll never leave her. whatever about the conviction, you know, that mental scar is there forever.
Yeah. Speaking of the family, you know, they've been waiting decades for this verdict. It's an investigation that's been running for such a long time, trying to find out who killed Irma. We now have an answer. Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ficconi, the men that killed Irma in 1999. Liz, how's the family at the moment?
Well, I think they're still sort of settling a bit. I was pleased to hear John say, "I can now sleep at night." So there was enormous relief. I presume they'll be going through a range of other emotions as time goes on, as we all do with grief, and their grief has been very prolonged. But so far, so good.
Yeah. James, you spent quite a bit of time with the family as the jury was deliberating, also throughout the trial. Did you get any insight into what that process was like for them and I guess how hard it would be at this kind of final stage?
No, I didn't, ultimately. And it's not my place to, I suppose, because unless you've gone through it, you can't even begin to understand. And I think, you know, the more you chat to them and the more you even try and consider it, you think, well, it's not even my place to even begin to imagine, let alone, I mean, you can guess and you can talk to them about it. But like you say, the sleepless nights and the thoughts that go through their head, I mean, it's horrific, really. And the fact that, you know, John has sat there through the entire trial, near enough every single moment, it just is, the strength that takes is staggering, it has to be said. But so to answer your question, no, I can't, because thankfully I haven't been through that. You know, you wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy, really. Mm. I mean, it really is brutal. It's something that they didn't choose, but has been just the back note, or probably the fore note, to their entire lives.
Yeah. Thinking about the strength of them throughout this whole process as well, you know, John Makita, as we've just been talking about, you know, he's kind of been the person who's driven this Who Killed Irma campaign for decades at this point, you know, having signs on the sides of roads in Canberra and, you know, kind of talking to police, being available for press conferences when rewards are offered, things like that, just kind of constantly putting himself in part of that, you know, is kind of incredible to continue pushing for this. And, you know, I wonder if without his work, we would be at the point that we're at now with a verdict as well. And also for Elizabeth, the entire Palasik's family, who've kind of had to carry this for such a long time. The process isn't quite finished yet. You know, we still have the sentencing coming. There's an appeal in the mix. Liz, what is the process from here?
Well, we are still in the appeal window, but usually that doesn't stop a sentencing happening. We're still looking for a date for sentencing. We've had a couple of directions hearings, but that hasn't given us a result yet. Perhaps next week we'll know that, but that I expect to be the next thing. At the end of the trial, the judge has ordered already pre-sentence reports, where they go through each of the accused's personal circumstances and look for, that so they can establish whether a sentence should be more or less off the standard sentencing. That process has already begun, and that takes quite a few weeks to happen. But we also haven't heard if anyone's planning to appeal. And so there's quite a bit to go yet. I'd be very surprised if this is over and done with by the end of the year.
The kind of, I suppose, symmetry of it, I think is worth noting that these two men are roughly the age that Irma and Gregor were that night in 1999. And when it comes to sentencing, whatever length, you know, they're in their early 70s, and the symmetry of those life moments, I think, is quite profound.
Mm. You have, I guess, Irma and Gregor's life taken from them at that point. You know, Gregor lived a couple of years past that brutal assault that night, but, you know, from kind of what we've heard through that, he, you know, obviously struggled through that period as well. And you have these two men now who may have their lives taken in a different way because of what happened on that night as well. I'd like to thank both of you for joining us for the case of the two intruders. It's been so wonderful to have you joining us for this series. Liz, your experience, your wisdom, your insight has been absolutely outstanding and invaluable throughout this. So thank you so much for being a part of this.
Well, it's been my pleasure. And this is a case I've sat on for so long, I was very happy to see it resolved.
Wonderful. Yeah, no, it's great to have you as part of it. And James, your analysis throughout this series has been fantastic. You have really taken us into the courtroom and helped us make sense of all of this with your special subject of the DNA on whose DNA is on the milk bottle, whose DNA is on the water jug. We could not have done it without you. So thank you so much for being here as well.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And of course, thank you for listening, for following along, for engaging with this series, for sending us emails and asking us questions. We really do appreciate your feedback and your involvement in this podcast. It's wonderful. And the case will be back in your feed on Tuesday. We'll have a whole new trial to follow along. So make sure you grab ABC Listen and get around that. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, to the ACT Newsroom, and also to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.